Welcome to the Council of Better Business Bureaus podcast, Better Business, Better Series, where we will explore top-of-mind topics with business and industry leaders to understand the leading trends and innovations that continue to push the envelope in today's marketplace.
Hello and welcome to The Bistro. I'm your host, Elena Spinola. Consumer protection sounds like a great thing, and for the most part, it is. Regulations are created to advance consumers' interests in the marketplace and to protect consumers from potential abuses from service providers or product manufacturers. But what happens when these well-intentioned consumer protection regulations impact consumers in a negative way, and what effect does that have on the marketplace? Joining us to shed more light on the unintended regulatory consequences in sectors of the economy that affect consumers is Kyle Burgess, former executive director and current advisory board member of Consumers Research. Kyle, thank you for joining us for this very timely conversation as we just celebrated National Consumer Protection Week and World Consumer Rights Day is just around the corner.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you bringing me in to talk about this really important topic today.
Absolutely. Well, you are a wealth of knowledge on this topic. And so as we get started here, just talk to us about what consumer protection currently includes. And should it perhaps be redefined to include other aspects of consumer welfare?
That's a really great question. The first thing that we actually need to consider before answering that question is who defines consumer protection. So over the years, Congress has passed a slew of regulations, starting in the early 1900s with the Federal Trade Commission Act. There are acts about antitrust law, which involves mergers and monopolies. There are a lot of financial services acts related to truth in lending or debt collection practices or financial reform. There are also a lot of laws related to food safety, cosmetics safety, drug safety. So there are a number of laws defined by Congress that determine what consumer protection is. There are also established by those laws a number of agencies that are responsible for determining what consumer protection is. So there's the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. There's the National Highway Safety Transportation Authority. There's the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And those are the non-financial ones. There's about 20 financial ones. So the Federal Trade Commission is general, but also financial. There's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And those are obvious consumer protection organizations. There's also the Securities and Exchange Commission that protects investors, but it also has other responsibilities like maintaining an orderly marketplace to promote capital formation. There are also regulators that you don't readily think of that ensure marketplace stability. These are known as prudential regulators, such as the Office of the Currency Comptroller, the Federal Reserve Board, the FDIC, and the FHFA. And so these regulators are responsible for ensuring the safety and the soundness of the financial system, which isn't necessarily an obvious link of consumer protection, but it's really important to make sure that we have good products and safe products and a stable marketplace. We also need to consider a little bit of history before talking about what consumer protection is. As I mentioned before, the Federal Trade Commission was established by the Federal Trade Act, and that happened in 1914. And that's one of the first and earliest kind of marks of the government on what consumer protection ought to be, because they established this agency that then protected consumers.
Sure.
My former organization, Consumers Research, was established in 1929, and it came out of a book called 100 Million Guinea Pigs, written by its co-founders. And as you can tell by the name, the book is about the American public being guinea pigs to corporations.
Interesting.
There wasn't the FDA was not yet established in its current form. That happened in 1938. It was previously, I think, like a chemistry administration, right? But there wasn't anything testing products and services and making sure that they were safe. So you would have arsenic in cereal, because there really wasn't, you know, consumer protection agencies out there looking after the American public.
Sure.
Then in the 1960s, we had a movement, what's commonly referred to now as Naderism. And that was like forceful campaigning and kind of protesting for improvements in safety standards and quality of goods. And then that resulted in the establishment of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And that, you know, specifically focuses on the safety and like reliability of products, mm-hmm. Physical products for the most part. And then we also had in the 1970s the National Commission on Consumer Finance, which led to a lot of like deregulation after all these many years of regulation for consumer finance. And then in the late 70s, there was also the establishment of what's known as the Consumer Welfare Standard. And so in antitrust law, when companies are, you know, considering merging, there are legal precedents for whether or not they can merge and if that's good or bad for consumers. And so this Consumer Welfare Standard determines whether or not those things are permissible. Well, it's one of the components that helps determine whether or not a merger can happen. And then, as I mentioned, there was a big period of deregulation in the 80s and 90s. There were also some introductions of new laws and things that protected consumers. And then in 2008, we all know what happened. There was the financial crisis. And after the financial crisis in 2010, we had the Dodd-Frank Act, the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, which established the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So all of that information to say that there is a long history behind the differing regulations that we have today, the differing federal agencies that we have today, and also the differing perspectives we have about those agencies and the laws that have essentially established the, I guess, marketplace of ideas for consumer protection. Mm-hmm. And there are differing views on, for example, the consumer welfare standard. Some people think that it is simply about consumer surplus and whether or not when a merger happens, do the benefits accrue to the consumers, as opposed to do the benefits accrue to the economy as a whole, which benefits consumers and businesses and the marketplace and has more long-run benefits to the consumers. So people, you know, they don't often think about long run, they think in the short run. And so all of that to say, there are differing perspectives on what consumer protection is, but everyone agrees that, you know, we should be safeguarding consumer rights, ensuring fair trade, competition, accurate information in the marketplace. But what often gets lost in the consumer protection discussion is the promotion of competition, not just regulation, because competition is a great driver for obviously competitive prices, but also consumer choice and higher quality goods and like robust consumer welfare. So not just do economic benefits accrue to consumers, but also do economic benefits accrue to society as a whole and thereby improve the quality of goods and services available to consumers.
Sure. We're going to talk about that competition in a moment, but I wanted to thank you for taking us through that evolution of sort of consumer protection regulation over the years. As I started out, you are definitely a wealth of knowledge on this topic, and we really appreciate you, again, walking us through that. As you mentioned, the competition, we know that consumer protection policies are often influenced by innovation and competition. Which sectors of the economy have been most affected over the years, and in what ways does that impact the regulations that are put into place?
I would say historically, originally, the industries that were most affected by consumer protection regulation were like health related, right? Or food and, you know, kind of all the basics. So like I said, early on, the FDA was established and the FTC was established, and that was mostly just to prevent like risky products and unhealthy things related to like the products that we consume physically, we eat.
Very important.
Yeah. But now a lot of regulation, I think, potentially harms or makes it complicated for new technological advancements and innovation to benefit consumers. So financial technology, technology in general, those areas are highly impacted by regulation. And that's not to say that it's not important to put an emphasis on things that are unknown quantities, but there is this inclination by regulators to respond early and quickly to problems that are solvable, will probably solve themselves through competition, right? If you're a business offering a service that's risky, but also interesting, there's another business that's going to come along and find a better way to deliver that service without compromising consumer safety.
Sure.
And so not to say that regulators shouldn't be watching those industries, but to regulate too soon might limit the quality and choice consumers have for different products. One major example where we're seeing this is in the sharing economy. So with Lyft and Uber, for example, there were a lot of stories about drivers harassing or attacking passengers because these companies weren't subject to the same kinds of regulations as the taxi industry. But if you think about the taxi industry as a whole and you talk to different police departments across the country, there are not really great records of assaults happening in taxis, right? We don't really know, like when people are assaulted, we don't really have really good data on, did it happen in a taxi?
Right, good point.
Yeah. Whereas with Lyft and Uber, you know, we use GPS to track those vehicles. They're linked to individual phone numbers. Phone numbers require a lot of information in order to get those like phone contracts. Even prepaid, there are some things you have to give up, information you have to give up to get a phone number. And also these companies do require background checks. So there are protections there that also exist for taxis, but there are greater protections like GPS tracking, where if, you know, I think that there's that like concern as a potential bad actor, if I know that all my movements are being tracked, maybe I'll think twice about that. Additionally, there's no cash involved in ride sharing. There is no risk of unlicensed rides. So like there's, you know, I'm sure you've heard of the term gypsy cab, right? You could end up in a taxi that's not actually licensed, but sure. You can't end up in an unlicensed Lyft or Uber. It happens through your app. So you know that they're an approved driver.
Right.
There's a rating system that lets you know how your driver is doing. Passengers are also rated, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah.
And there are photos uploaded so that you can look at your driver when you get in the vehicle to make sure that that's the driver that's supposed to be driving you. So there's news that kind of benefits from kind of creating some controversy around this this new technology. And then there's the reality, which is that this new technology actually might be a lot safer. And we don't have reasonable data yet mm-hmm. on both sides to determine that. But lots of municipalities have banned Uber and Lyft from practicing in their municipalities. So they're limiting, you know, people from being able to access services where late night, if you've had a few too many drinks and you want to get a ride home, you can't use that service, which is more cost effective often, not always, but often than a traditional sure. taxi. Or you might live in a town where traditional taxis are hard to come by.
Right.
So you make the terrible choice of driving home drunk.
Right. Right. So there's another great example of sort of the unintended consequences of these regulations. Thank you for sharing that example. What are some ways that consumer rights organizations are working to revise current legislation or move forward with a different approach to consumer protection policies?
So unfortunately, there's no single coordinated movement among advocacy groups, and there's also limited coordination among consumer protection agencies. Some of the types of approaches involve consumer education campaigns, comment letters, or soft advocacy like op-eds, or harder advocacy like lobbying. And consumer advocacy, you know, such as the kind of advocacy that Consumers Research does, focuses on educating policymakers and pushing for evidence-based policymaking. So not just using your gut to make decisions because it seems like the right choice, but also looking at data and other kind of qualitative assessments to make regulations.
Sure. And Kyle, is there any way that consumers can engage in the process of changing the current protection practices that perhaps might limit their consumer choices?
Yeah, you would be surprised, but calling your member of Congress is actually very effective. It's a lot more effective than you would think. They do listen and they do care, and they take notes if you call or if you email. They also pay attention to those. You can also participate in town halls or public comments. If an agency or even a federal agency or a state agency put out a request for comment, anybody can comment on that, not just advocacy organizations. A private citizen can do that. Some federal agencies go on roadshows to talk about new policies that are coming out. Social media is alarmingly effective.
Yes, it is.
And you can also support organizations. So this is my consumers research plug, but you can support organizations that you know support your interests, right? Do your research, make sure that they are aligned with your personal interests, but do your research and, you know, work with them to help them help you. And obviously, the most important thing is vote. Vote for people who will pull a federal agency or a state agency back in line if it's overstepping its bounds, or vote for someone who will do the opposite, like make that agency be more effective because you don't think that it's doing enough to protect consumers. So whatever your interests are, vote. And you can also vote with your dollars. And I don't mean donate to campaigns. I mean, if you are unhappy about the businesses that are serving you, if you feel like a bank opening a checking account in your name when you didn't do that is a bad thing, then you need to change banks. Or if you feel like a business better aligns with your interests because you know that they have a clean supply chain, they don't use labor from other countries that doesn't take care of their labor market, then go to a business that uses a clean supply chain and vote with your dollars.
Sure. Thank you so much for sharing these tips that really can help empower consumers through this. We really, really appreciate you joining us today here, Kyle. I feel like this conversation can continue much longer, but can you share a website where people can find more information? You mentioned Consumers Research.
Yeah, so I would definitely go to consumersresearch.org, consumers with an S. I would also look at the federal agency websites, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission. Those organizations have a lot of information available to consumers to help them make better, smarter decisions for themselves.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you.
I'm Elena Spinola, host of the Bistro Podcast. We thank you for listening, and we ask you to give us your feedback on this episode. Go ahead and rate us on iTunes and share our episodes to help inspire others. Until next time, it has been my pleasure discussing better business and consumer protection with you.
You just enjoyed the Bistro Podcast. Be sure to tune in next month for a brand new episode. To learn more about our other shows, visit betterbusiness.blueberry.com. That's betterbusiness.blueberry.com and subscribe. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the Better Business Bureau, Council of Better Business Bureaus, or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Blueberry's Terms of Service.